The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
Right, back here for another episode of the Midwest Swing Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We're part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find us on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I'm your host, Brandon Warren, and you can find me on Twitter at Brandon_Warren. Today, producing the program is Tom Schreier. He's on Twitter at TSchreier3. He is the co-founder of Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage. Yep. And how are you doing today?
Doing well. How are you?
Can't complain. Got a daily podcast that we ran late last night. Twins get one game closer to 500 with, I'd say, a fairly good chance with Irvin Santana on the mound today to get back to 500 with a 3-2 win over Texas last night. So check that out. Just about a 20-minute soliloquy of me breaking down Phil Hughes' outing. He looked, I think fairly good. Did get some help from the strike zone, from his outfield help, or his outfielders rather. Obviously he's going to get help from them every time out. But the bullpen came in, picked up the slack for him over the final three innings, and a three-run double by Brian Dozier got them all the offense they needed to take the first game of that series. Natural segue here with Phil Hughes being brought up is to our guest today, Mike Agzisa of CBS Sports and one of their primary baseball writers. Mike, how are we doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Any fond memories of Phil Hughes? I know that by the time you left, you guys were ready to have him out of there, but there's got to be some fond memories, right?
Yeah, in 2009, he was Mariano Rivera's primary setup man that season, and the Yankees started that year, and Hughes started that season in AAA, I believe, and they called him up to make like a spot start or two in April or whatever it was, and they were getting ready to send him down because they didn't need him in the rotation anymore, and they decided, you know what, let's just keep him in the bullpen. And he was awesome in the bullpen that season. And, he was set at Matt Mariano every year. The next year they put him back in the rotation. And I think that was the year he made the All-Star game. Hughes made the All-Star game kind of randomly one season with the Yankees. I think it was 2010. And I think he actually took the loss in the All-Star game that year. But he made the All-Star team. And he would, Hughes had some okay seasons with the Yankees as a starter, some really bad kind of injury seasons. But when I think of Phil Hughes as a Yankee, I'm going to remember 2009 when he was a really big part of that championship team.
Well, I think he actually is the winning pitcher in the last Twins postseason game, too, which is actually a weird, trivial concept. I believe the loser was Brian Dunsing, which is also pretty disappointing when you think about as a Twins fan that he was starting the postseason.
He still
game.
Remembers this like pretty vividly.
Oh, I'm sure he does. Yeah.
I talked to him about that. And yeah, he was.
Phil Hughes is the winning pitcher of, I think it was like game four of the 2010 American League Division Series, or the ALDS. So yeah, lots of angles to attack here. But the first primary reason here that we have you on today is you did write a really good article, I think it was 3-4 days ago, for CBS Sports on the subtle but important tweaks that the Twins have made as they are, right around 500 through, at that point, 16 games, at this point, 19 games to start the season. Without giving away too much of it, because we do want people to go check out your work on CBSSports.com, what were some of your findings as far as what the Twins are doing better that might not be obvious to the casual fan?
The big thing to me was the outfield defense. And, I stumbled across this. I was just kind of looking around at some, defensive stats are so kind of, so especially early in the season, they're hard to trust. So I just kind of was looking at defensive efficiency, which I don't know if the readers know, but it's basically just a percentage of batted balls the team turns into outs. And last year, the Twins, I think they were 28th or 29th, and this year was first. And I was like, whoa, that's a big change. And what was different there, the biggest difference to me was the outfield defense. Robbie Grossman is now the DH, and Miguel Sano, and that whole right field experiment last year, I felt like that was doomed from the start. It's not really Sano's fault. He shouldn't have put him in that position in the first place. Sano is, he's a big dude. He's not very mobile. It just wasn't going to work out there. So getting Grossman and Sano out of the outfield, getting Kepler in there full-time this year, a full season of him, Rosario, the same thing, that's just going to improve their defense so much, and it has already this year. And the other thing is, you know, the Twins, historically, they're just kind of this belief that they're a pitch-to-contact team who get ground balls, but they're actually one of the most extreme fly ball pitching staffs. They were last year. They are again this year. So they're getting all these balls in the air, and they have a better outfield defense, and bingo, all of a sudden, defense efficiency. They're the best team in baseball. They're turning more batted balls into outs, and that, I think, is the biggest difference for the Twins between last season and this season overall, not just defensively. I'm talking about the entire team.
I think another thing, too, that you dove in on was behind the plate, and I mentioned this last night with Chris Jimenez as the backup. It almost felt like 10 times more defensively capable than Juan Centeno back there last year. I think Centeno, in part-time duty, was one of the worst as far as passed balls. Didn't have a particularly good season throwing people out, which is strange because he was supposed to be a good catch-and-throw guy. I think he was the first guy to catch Billy Hamilton in the big leagues for an unsuccessful stolen base attempt. But, yeah, it was just a mess back there with Kurt Suzuki and Juan Centeno. Teams kind of ran wild. They've thrown out 6 of 13 attempted base thieves so far this season. So, you know, there's a lot of layers to that. Obviously, the pitcher's keeping guys close plays into it, and obviously the time it takes them to get to the plate, you know, the 1-2s and 1-3s instead of 1-5s. But I think behind the plate, not only throwing guys out, but blocking pitches, and also, most importantly, pitch receiving has been obviously a big deal as well. I think Jason Castro kind of typified the direction they were headed for this offseason. But, you know, when you look at this catching tandem, you know, how much can they help the existing pitching staff, and how much can they make this team better over the course of a full season, in your opinion?
I think they're going to be a big help. And, you know, I'm one of the pitch framing skeptics. I don't deny it's obviously a valuable skill. I'm just a little uncertain that we can put an exact run saved value on it right now. You know, I think, you know, we have several years of data now, and you could see the same guys are at the top every year. The same guys are at the bottom of it every year. So we get a pretty good idea of who's a good framer, even if we don't know exactly how much they're helping. And Castro is one of those guys who has consistently been one of the best. And Kurt Suzuki was one of the guys who was consistently among the worst. And turning these borderline pitches into strikes, that's a big deal for a pitching staff. You know, and even if you don't agree with the exact numbers that are out there, getting more borderline strikes is going to be a big help. And, you know, Kurt Suzuki is one of those guys whose defensive reputation was inflated beyond what it really is. You know, early in his career, he was a good defender, but nowadays he's not so great, whereas Castro's still kind of in the prime of his career. You know, he had that one huge offensive season with Astros. I think he had like 30 home runs or something. He's never really come close to that again, but he's always been a good defender. And I think with the Twins, they're kind of starting to break in some younger pitchers. You know, Berrios is going to get another chance at some point, and Steven Gonzalez as well. They'll be up soon enough.
Mejia too.
Yeah, Mejia as well. I keep forgetting about him, but they have these young pitchers who are coming up. It's good they're going to have this good defensive veteran catcher, and I'm not saying that Castro is going to solve all the problems that Berrios had last year, because Berrios was terrible last season. I don't think he just changed the catcher. That's not going to fix everything, but I think it's going to help. And if you're a young team and you're going to spend money on a young rebuilding team and you're going to spend money on a free agent, a good veteran defensive catcher isn't a bad place to spend it, because you're trying to groom all these young pitchers. And it's not just Castro, it is Jimenez as well, because like you said, Juan Centeno, I don't think he's a major league catcher at all, but they stuck with him last year. And, you know, John Ryan Murphy, when he was with the Yankees, I thought he was one of their best, most underrated players, because he was phenomenal as their backup catcher in 2015. And I have no idea what happened to him last season, but he was excellent as McCann's backup that one year. And I thought he would eventually take over as the starter for the Twins, but it's not happening. And so they had to go out and get the help. And I think Castro it's better to go out and get a Castro who you know is a good defensive player on everything, throwing, receiving, the whole nine, than trying to go year to year with a guy like Suzuki who's okay, but you really don't want to play him every year. I thought the Twins were smart to go out and get Castro, even if maybe they're not ready to win right now. He's someone who's going to help them as part of this rebuild.
Yeah, and I think that also no team benefits more from pitch receiving or framing, whatever you want to call it, the inconsistent or, you know, whatever we can't put actual ratings on it that we're confident in. A team that doesn't strike anybody out, though, is going to benefit the most from that. I think that's pretty obvious.
Yeah, of course. And the Twins, you know, that was the thing all these years. They pitched to contact, and there was always some outliers there, like Liriano and Santana, obviously. But, you know, right now, they really don't have a big strikeout guy in the pitching staff. You know, I know Santana's been unbelievable early on, but I'm not sure he's going to keep up this pace all season. they have some guys coming who can miss bats, and that's
right.
Going to be a bit of a change of pace for them. But for now, you know, you got guys like Hughes and who don't really miss a ton of bats, so you do need those borderline strikes more than ever before, really. So it's good they're getting much better catching defensively this year. And, you know, I talked about the defensive efficiency before. This is something that doesn't show up in that, you know, because they're not stealing a borderline pitch and turning it into a strike is not a batted ball being turned into an out. But it does, you know, put the pitcher in a better count, and that absolutely has results on the field.
So would you say you put some credence into the rankings of framers as opposed to the run values, as in this guy was the best framer, he wasn't worth 16 runs necessarily or 20 whatever runs, but you can maybe with some certainty say players 1, 2, 3, and 4 were four of the best framers in the league, in perhaps in that order?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, like every other defensive stat, it's good to use this over multiple years instead
sure.
of 1 year at a time or 1 month at a time or whatever. And, you know, if you pull up the pitch framing leaderboards over the last, whatever, it's 5, 6 years now, you see Castro's always at the top. Brian McCann is always there. Jonathan Lucroy was there up until last season. And the same thing with Yadier Molina. And I don't know if that's just a one-year outlier or maybe these are guys nearing the end of their career. Not the end of their career, but guys who are starting to decline a little bit. I think when you see the same guys year after year, that adds reliability to this. And, you know, who knows if they're really saving 30 runs a year with their pitch framing. And it seems a little bit extreme to me, but I think you could use these numbers directionally and get an idea of who's great at it, who's bad at it, who is just okay at it. And as always, just the more information we have, the better. And I think it's good that we have multiple different pitch framing calculations. You know, Baseball Perspectives has their own, Stat Corner has their own, so it's good to, you know, I know people complain like there's two versions of WAR, that's not bad. I see that as a good thing because it's, you know, it's not a perfect model and you kind of push each other to get better. So, yeah, I think it's okay directionally, the pitch framing stuff. You know, I don't put a ton of stock into the exact runs frame numbers, but it gives you a pretty good idea who's great at it, who's bad at it, and who's just okay.
So after breaking down the Twins in the depth that you did, they're 9-10 right now. What did you get a sense for their ceiling was this year? I said 80 wins in January, and I think that they're about average. I think they do have some exciting young talent. They've got some interesting glue guys at the edges of their roster, and they do have some better clubhouse stuff. You know, guys that have won before and maybe weren't important players on winning teams. You know, Craig Breslow, Chris Jimenez, but can help young players come to grips with certain things that maybe they didn't have as far as accountability partners or you know, guys they can go to in the clubhouse last year. So in that sense, I think they can keep things from snowballing, and I don't think too many teams let games get away from them like the Twins did last year. And so I do think, yeah, I think 78, 80 wins is probably their ceiling. What did you come away with thinking after you broke this team down?
Yeah, I thought somewhere around 78 wins, 75 to 78 seemed okay to me. You know, some things go right, they could get to 80. The defense has improved, and, you know, it's really going to come down to how the young players perform. And Miguel Sano has been, I know he's hitting like 220-something, but he's been really, really good because he hits for so much power. He takes all his walks. You know, he seems like the kind of player, casual fans are not going to like him because he doesn't hit for average and he strikes out a bunch, but he's a really good hitter because hitting so much power, draws the walks, gets on base. And, you know, this year was, I kind of pegged Byron Buxton as being a breakout player this year, but that doesn't seem to be happening. I have no idea what's going on there. You know, Buxton, the first time I saw the kid play, it was at the Futures game in 2013, and I swear to God, it looked like he was, like, put on this earth to play baseball. He was, you don't realize how big he is, and then you see how fast he runs. He just looked like the perfect kind of baseball player. And all throughout his minor league career, everything pointed to stardom. And I just have no idea what's happening there. And I thought this would be a big year for Buxton because he was good in September last year. I thought that was kind of the start of a breakout for him, and it just hasn't carried over yet. That's, you know, that has to be, I think, the number one concern for the Twins right now is just getting Buxton right. You know, he's still he's still good enough defensively that even when he's hitting, you know, when he's on the interstate, he still saves so many runs in the field that it's worth having in the lineup.
Yep.
But ultimately, they want this guy to hit because he has a chance to be an impact hitter. And, you know, maybe he's a Carlos Gomez type who needed 2,000 plate appearances before he figured it out in the big leagues. You know, that's kind of what the Twins have to hope now because he's been so bad early on. But ultimately, again, the Twins are going to come down to this season. How do the young players develop? You know, does Sano have a full, complete season where he's just a monster on the middle of the plate? Does Buxton figure anything out? You know, Rosario, Kepler, some of the pitchers. You know, young players, it's always pretty dicey. And if they click, they could get to 80 wins, 82 wins. If they have some struggles, which is usually how it goes, I think they're going to be closer to 78 wins.
Yeah, I think Buxton looked better last night. Took two walks. I mean, Martin Perez is kind of known for handing those out. Mm-hmm. But he did take better plate appearances. Went to three ball counts, I think, in three of his plate appearances. So there was some sign of the changes that he and hitting coach James Rowson have kind of taken. I think Rowson would actually be someone you'd be familiar with because I think he worked in the Yankees organization for a little while as well. And in fact, I think he went Yankees, Cubs, Yankees, if I'm not mistaken. But this is a good transition, actually, when you talk about players who needed time to figure things out. I got to ask you about Aaron Hicks and what he's up to because obviously the numbers are good and it looks like he's playing fairly regularly. I'm not sure if that's at the expense of Brett Gardner or who exactly. But how does he look so far here through about a baker's dozen worth of games?
He looks a lot better than he did last season. And I thought last year the biggest problem was that Hicks just did not play consistently. And
yeah,
there were like two stretches. You know, early in the season, there was a stretch when Alex Rodriguez went on the disabled list. So the Yankees put Carlos Beltran at DH and played Hicks every day for like 2 weeks. And he was really good. Mm-hmm. And then after the trade deadline, they traded Beltran. They got rid of A-Rod. So all these at-bats opened up. So they played Hicks regularly. And he played really well for 3 weeks, and then he pulled his hamstring and missed a bunch of weeks, and he kind of put an end to that. But he's looked good so far this year, and I think, you know, Joe Girardi has made an effort to rotate his outfielders to make sure everybody plays with four outfielders, make sure he rotates guys in and out, because Hicks has played, it's been all three outfield spots. Gardner has sat some, Ellsbury has sat some, Aaron Judge has even sat some, as good as he's been. So they seem to be making an effort to get Hicks in the lineup more often. You know, I looked it up yesterday, and he's at like 44 plate appearances, Hicks, right now, I think. And last year, like, he didn't get his 44th plate appearance until the end of May. And they're just going to make sure he plays more, and I think that's helped him stay in a rhythm because part of the last season, Hicks was never a bench player, and that's a difficult adjustment to make when you're used to playing every day. So they're making sure he plays. I think he's got four home runs already.
Yep.
He's drawn more walks than strikeouts, like a lot more walks than strikeouts. He's always had good plate discipline. And, you know, I feel like the Yankees are, they want to play him more, but it's tough to get him in the lineup because Judge has been so good you can't take him out, and he's part of your future. Ellsbury's owed so much money, and he's been actually good so far this season, even though he's not been good the last few years. Ellsbury's started well, and Gardner has not started well. But he's the longest tenured player on the team. He's one of their biggest leaders in the clubhouse, and they don't want to just cast him aside in favor of Hicks. So they have a bit of a problem now just getting these guys in the lineup as much as they want to. All they can do is rotate them, and Hicks has played well early on. He had a good spring training. It was, I think he said it was Hicks or Judge for right field, but I never really thought it would be Hicks unless Judge was just terrible in the spring, which didn't happen. So right now they're basically just rotating Hicks in the four outfield spots, in the three outfield spots with the four outfielders there, and that's really all they can do. And he looks so much more comfortable at the plate this year. I'm not sure he's not going to be this good all season, obviously, but
yeah,
it looks like he'll be more productive than last year, where, I mean, if he didn't play regularly, he didn't produce at all this season, and it was you know, there were more than a few fans here who were ready to just kind of cut bait and let go and move on to somebody else, because the Yankees have a lot of really good outfielders in AAA, and fans are always eager to see the next big thing. And the Yankees, it looks like they're smart to kind of just keep hanging on to Hicks. And because, you know, you think about it, he's a switch hitter, he runs well, plays good defense, has some power. That's somebody worth keeping around.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to keep making room for him in the lineup as long as he keeps hitting.
So Aaron Judge has to be a lot of fun to watch. 6'7", 280-plus pounds, absolutely crushing the ball this year. First of all, because I'm going to ask this because probably nobody else would care, but how's his defense? And then two, just how fun is he to watch every day? Because especially when he's like next to Ronald Torres on the field, and you obviously see like a Danny DeVito, Arnold Schwarzenegger vibe there. But just what's he like to have on the team?
Yeah, he's definitely the most interesting player to watch because baseball players are not supposed to be that big. And when they are that big, they're not supposed to be these good at defense. He's a good athlete. He runs well. You know, he's not Brett Gardner running around in right field. But Judge's, at worst, I think he's an average defender. I think he's probably a bit above average. He's got a great arm. You know, it's mm-hmm. the best outfield arm the Yankees have had in a very long time. Their arms have not been good the last few seasons. That's the one thing with Judge when he was coming up through the minors. You know how scouts would always compare them to, oh, he's the next, you know, Judge, it's the next Giancarlo Stanton, which is always, that was always a little silly because, Giancarlo Stanton, he was in the big leagues at like 22, and by the time he was, you know, the age when Judge made his debut, he had like 100 and something big home runs in the big leagues, and that was always an unfair comparison.
Mm-hmm.
But the other scouts, the other comps the scouts would make on this guy were like Blake Griffin and Jimmy Graham. That's the kind of athlete he is. He's so big. He's such a good athlete, and that's who they compared him to. And, you know, you see a guy that big, it's easy to think he's just kind of this slow, lumbering slugger who just tries to hit home runs every time up, and that's not really Judge. He's a good athlete. He helps in the field. He helps in the bases. He's a good hitter, too. He's not just, you know, he's going to strike out because his strike zone's so big, but the other night, the Yankees were down a run in the ninth inning against the Pirates. You know, he was down 0-2 to Tony Watson, and he just took a single the other way to start a rally that, you know, they didn't score, but it started, gave him a chance there. And that's just something that you don't really associate with a big guy like Judge. He's a really good natural hitter. And I had somebody tell me once that Judge's body would prevent him from being as good of a hitter as he is because his strike zone is just so big. There's so much to cover there that he's going to strike out. But he's a really interesting player. He's kind of like a freak of nature. You don't really see players like this. And his batting practices are unbelievable. You know, I've been covering the Yankees for years now, since before the new stadium opened. And every single day in batting practice, he hits balls over the restaurant they have in center field and into the concourse. And I have never once in my life seen that happen until Aaron Judge showed up. And he does it like every single day. It's unbelievable when he makes contact, the ball just flies off his bat. Like, I know now we have Statcast and exit velocity and all that, and Judge's, I think last time I looked, he had something like 5 of the top 10 exit velocities this year. He's a monster, and it's, you know, seeing how bad he was last season and the adjustments he's made this year, where he's basically just stopped chasing out of the zone, and now he's laying off those sliders down and away. Going from one year to the next like that, it's really been impressive, just how quickly he made the adjustment. So now, you know, I don't think he's going to hit as well as he has all year, but he's certainly a much more viable offensive player now. He looks much more comfortable to play, and it's really kind of fascinating to watch because he's just such an anomaly compared to the average baseball player.
Size-wise, he makes Greg Bird look like a baby bird, I think, and it's kind of funny because Greg Bird's no small man either. What's gone on with his slow start, though? Obviously, 14 games, hitting 104, not entirely different than Buxton's start. You know, a few more walks, maybe a few less strikeouts, but obviously struggling a bit, and I think people had some higher hopes for him going into this season. What have you seen from him so far?
Yeah, this was going to be kind of an interesting season for Bird because he came up in 2015, played every day for like 6 weeks, and he was really good. And then he hurt his shoulder during an off-season workout. He missed all of last season. So now he came into this season not just coming off shoulder surgery, but he was going to be playing a full big league season for the first time. And that's always, you never really know what you're going to get when that happens. And he had just an unbelievable spring training. He looked completely healthy. He led everybody in home runs, led in extra base hits, and it looked like he would step right into the lineup, pick up where he left off in 2015. And instead, he's been just terrible. And, you know, the last week or two, he's looked better at the plate, hitting the ball harder, getting in the air more often. He's not swinging and missing as much as he did earlier in this season. And in the first week, he had he fouled the ball off his foot at the end of spring training, and he Yankees said it was still bothering him, so they tried to give him some rest there. He also came down with the flu for like 3 days, and they just gave him like a 5-day break where they didn't play him. The Yankees have Chris Carter on the bench who doesn't really do anything other than play first base and hit home runs, so they were able to put Carter in the lineup for a couple of days, sit Bird. And since he's come back from that, he's looked better at the plate, even though the numbers aren't there yet. You know, he's still hitting the ball hard. He's getting it in the air, and I feel like as long as he does that, he's going to be fine. But I didn't expect him, you know, I didn't expect him to hit like he did in spring training. I didn't expect him to come out and hit 100 for the first month of the season. This was a bit of a surprise. But as long as Bird is healthy, I think he'll be okay. You know, he's probably, you know, everybody talks about Judge now this with the start he's had. We were talking about Gary Sanchez last year, and I feel like Bird has the chance to be the best all-around offensive player there of those three guys between hitting for average, getting on base, hitting for power. I think he's the most refined offensive player they have there among the young guys. So I think it's just a matter of time. As long as his ankle's healthy after fouling the pitch off, and as long as his shoulder's healthy, that's the big thing. If the shoulder's fine, they give him enough plate appearances, I think Bird will be okay.
So obviously you mentioned or you invoked the name of Gary Sanchez on the disabled list. What are you hearing about how quickly he'll be back? And then obviously Austin Romine's been pretty good in his absence. I feel like those two guys, in addition to the fact that they still had Brian McCann, was why they were able to trade John Ryan Murphy in the first place. But yeah, you know, what's the dynamic like there with Sanchez working his way back and Romine playing well, and what are you seeing here?
Yeah, you know, the Yankees, the last, I think it's 6 years running now, they've traded a big league catcher in the offseason, which is just, it's like, teams usually don't have that many catchers.
Oh, yeah, like Cervelli, and I'm sure there's lots of others.
Chris Stewart.
Russell Martin, was he traded?
He wasn't traded. They just let him go as a free agent. So they've had 5 or 6 years in a row now. They just have gotten rid of a big league catcher in the offseason, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, it is.
To still do all that and still have Gary Sanchez. And, you know, Sanchez played 4 games, and he hurt his shoulder taking a swing, or hurt his biceps taking a swing. So he's been out for 2 weeks. They said when he got hurt, it would be a four-week rehab. So back in big league games in 4 weeks. So they're still 2 weeks away from that. But Sanchez has started throwing. He started hitting. Everything seems to be okay. And, you know, Austin Romine has been phenomenal as the starter, which is one of the reasons the Yankees have gotten off to this really nice start. I think they're 11-7 right now. It's because Romine is hitting like 300 or something like that. He's stepped right in as the everyday catcher and played well. They haven't had Didi Gregorius, but Ronald Torres has played well. You know, for all the focus on the young players, it's the veteran guys who have really kind of propelled the Yankees to this hot start. And I think once they get Sanchez back, once they get Gregorius back, and once Bird just starts hitting in general, it'll kind of compensate for, you know, Chase Headley not hitting 400 anymore and Starlin Castro not slugging 600 anymore. When those guys come back to earth, you kind of hope that Sanchez coming back and Gregorius coming back and Bird starting hitting, that'll kind of compensate it for a bit. So, you know, Sanchez didn't hit in his first 4 games, which was really just kind of baseball being baseball more than anything. There wasn't any real problems there. He just had some tough luck for a few days. And once he's healthy, I don't think he's going to hit like he did last year. You know, he's not going to hit 20 homers in 50 games again. That was never going to happen. But I think he's still 25-homer power-hitting catcher who, if it wasn't for the injury, might be the best catcher in the AL right now, I think. At least the best hitting catcher in the AL. And once they get him back, I think he'll go back to hitting not like last year, but certainly more than enough to hit in the middle of the lineup.
Starlin Castro is still just 27 years old. That's almost impossibly young for how long he's been around. And what are reasonable expectations for him? Obviously not going to sustain this early start, but do you have any sort of hopes for him, or are you just kind of he is who he is at this point?
You know, Castro is such a difficult guy to cover, to really follow, because he's been in the big leagues for like 8 years now. Uh-huh. I think he's got over 4,500 plate appearances, telling you that he's not that good of a hitter. But he's still 27, and then he goes on these runs where he just hits the snot out of the ball, and you think, all right, he's figuring it out now. And he did it a few times last year, and it never lasted. You know, he'd have a hot 2 or 3 weeks, and then he'd come back to earth. And he did the same thing last year. He started out great in April, and was like, whoa, this guy came to New York. He's re-energized. He's going to be this great player, and it didn't last. I mean, He got off to this. He's off to a great start this season, and this one has lasted much longer than last year. Last year was basically a week. Now it's still a full 3 weeks. Castro's still really hitting well, and you know, part of me says it's not real. This is just Castro on a hot streak. He's going to go back to swinging at everything out of the strike zone soon because that's what he does. And but still, at the back of your mind, it's always there that hey, maybe he is figuring it out. Mm-hmm. He's so talented. You could see the power he has. That's the one thing he did last year that was better than any other year in his career was hit for power. And even when you consider moving to Yankee Stadium and everybody was hitting home runs last year, he still had more power than ever before. He's hitting for power again this year. So I think that might be real improvement there. The question is whether he's going to stop swinging out of the zone so much because he gets himself out so many times that that's what really holds him back. And there's some improvement there this year. And I just, my head says, no, this is not real. This is just a hot streak. And then the other side of me says, but it might be. You just never really know with Castro because he's so young, so talented that he just might figure it out. And, you know, the longer this goes on, the longer I'll buy into it. But right now, I'm nothing more than cautiously optimistic, and even that's kind of pushing it. I still think this is just Castro on a hot streak until I'm going to need to see a little bit more.
Through 12 games, Chris Carter looks more like a guy that was a street free agent for as long as he was, and the kind of guy that might not even make the season without being DFA'd. So I got to ask what your diagnosis of his early start is. And second of all, how in the hell did he hit a triple?
You know, the triple was it was kind of an outfield mistake. It should have been a double. He hit a line drive off. I mean, it almost cleared the wall. And, you know, it just hopped off the wall away from the outfielder. And he liked it. And, you know, the throw, there was a runner on base. So the throw went home there. They scored it a triple. Should have been a double and moved to third on the error. And it was almost a home run. But there was definitely some, like, outfield shenanigans there. It wasn't a clean triple.
Yeah.
But
might expect.
Yeah, you know, with the Yankees, I thought it was smart to pick up Carter. Even though he's a very flawed player, he was sitting out there in February. The Yankees didn't know what they were going to get from Bird, didn't know about the status of his shoulder. So you get this guy who had 41 home runs last year for $3 million a year. You know, why not? And the problem is that Bird came out of the gate so, or at least in spring training, he gave the Yankees every reason to put him in the lineup every day. They didn't really have room for Carter. He pinch hit a few times against lefties. He had a pinch hit home run again Saturday, I think it was. You know, it was like the perfect situation against a lefty with men on base, and he ended up hitting his first home run. It was like the perfect situation there to use Carter. But otherwise, he's only started when Bird was nursing his ankle injury, and maybe once in a while against lefties. He's a really imperfect bench piece because you can't play a position other than first base or DH, and he's not going to pinch run for anyone, and ideally you'd use him against lefties. Mm-hmm. And the Yankees, you look at their lineup, they don't really have many guys to pinch hit for. You know, they've been using him to pinch hit for Torres, and that's really all they can do with him. So I'm not sure how much Carter's going to last here. You know, with Bird not hitting, that's going to buy Carter some time because the Yankees, at the very least, they're going to platoon Bird and Carter until Bird starts hitting. So, you know, he'll stick around for that. Otherwise, I'm not really sure what they're going to do with Carter. And I get the sense that he's going to be gone by the trade deadline either. I don't know. I'm probably not going to trade him. They'll probably end up just designating him for assignment, which is what happened with Garrett Jones a few years ago. The Yankees had him and
former twin.
It looks on paper like Jones was the perfect fit for the Yankees because he could play right field, play first base, play DH, and the Yankees had Beltran, who was injury-prone at right, DeShera, who was injury-prone at first, and A-Rod, who was injury-prone at DH, and he thought Jones would end up getting 400 at-bats between those positions, and it just didn't happen. He didn't play, and they ended up cutting him loose at the trade deadline, and I get the feeling, you know, Carter made sense because you didn't know what you're going to get from Greg Bird, but he's not really playing enough to produce, to keep himself in a rhythm, and I think he's going to end up being pushed aside at some point. You know, he hit the big home runs, I think it was Saturday, so that's his like signature Yankee moment. He at least contributed to one win there, and you know, it's a tough position for Carter because you think about the guy hit 41 home runs last year, got non-tendered, had to settle for a smaller one-year contract on a team that doesn't play him every day. So now whenever he does hit free agency again, whether it's at midseason or the end of the year, he's going to be this one-dimensional slugger coming off a poor season. It's really it just shows where baseball's heading now. Where these one-dimensional guys, just teams are just they're not interested in them at all.
What's the Gleyber hysteria like for Gleyber Torres? I know he's injured, but he's getting close to coming back in the minor leagues. And I know that obviously he's you know a very exciting prospect near the top of every list. Are fans really getting excited to see him in New York in the semi-near future?
Not in the near future. You know, I think it's possible he'll make his debut, his big league debut later in the season. You know, when Gregorius got hurt, he was away at the World Baseball Classic and he got hurt and the Yankees needed a shortstop and Torres was hitting the snot out of the ball in spring training. Everybody wanted to see Thorius get the job, but that was never going to happen. The Yankees weren't going to do it because Torres had never played above single A, and there are 40-man issues they would have had to work through, so that wasn't ever going to happen. He got up to like a bit of a slow start in double A. Then he got hurt. It's a very minor shoulder injury. They were only supposed to miss like 2 or 3 days. They said put him on a disabled list anyway to make sure we kind of knock it out. And so he's still out right now. He's going to be back later this week. And you know, I think there's a chance that he'll reach the big leagues later this year. And you look at the history of prospects similar to Torres, 20-year-old shortstop with a right-handed hitter who's good on both sides of the ball. You know, I went through a few months ago the scouting grades on MLB.com to find similar players, right-handed hitting shortstops who are 20 years old, and the names that came up with were like Carlos Correa and Xander Bogaerts and Addison Russell, you know, and those guys went from double A, started the season 20 years old in double A, and they reached the big leagues later that year, and I feel like Gleyber can do the same thing as long as his shoulder doesn't act up, and mm-hmm. The Yankees are sort of preparing Torres for it because they've played him at second base and third base, so they're trying to figure out how to get him in the lineup. And yeah, fans are really excited about Torres. You know, when the Yankees got him, I thought maybe the hype was a little out of control, but he's a better player than I realized. And I think it's possible we'll see him maybe in August, and really kind of depends what the Yankees need and do they trade anyone at the deadline or whatever. But I think it's possible, and fans want to see him now, but that wasn't going to happen. I think August is more likely.
So it looks to me on the pitching side of things that Michael Pineda and Luis Severino are kind of having this battle back and forth of doing virtually the same thing. What has been your take on their starts? Obviously, tons of strikeouts, no walks, lots of home runs, relatively speaking, for the time frame that they've pitched. I think it's 9 home runs in the span of only 43 and a third innings pitched, but still good numbers otherwise. You know, what do you take away from that? Obviously, that's Pineda's calling card, but Severino, obviously a young pitcher that people are interested in as well. You know, where do you stand on these guys?
Yeah, Pineda, as far as I'm concerned, nothing has changed. He's the last 2 or 3 years, he's had his starts where he was completely dominant and looked like he would win the Cy Young Award, and then 5 days later, he doesn't make it out of the third inning. And he's done that already this year. You know, his first start, didn't make it out of the fourth inning. Next time out, he retired the first 20 batters he faced, I think it was, and then he was great again 5 days later, and last time out, he struggled again. So as far as I'm concerned, Pineda is the same as always. Severino is a much different story because he came up in 2015, was really good for, I think he made 10 starts, 11 starts, something like that. So he came up in 2015 as this highly touted prospect, had success. Landed himself a rotation spot in 2016, and he was so bad in his first, whatever it was, 7 or 8 starts. He was so unbelievably bad that I thought the Yankees were going to send him to AAA had he not got hurt. He hurt his triceps in the middle of a start. They pulled him, put him on the DL, and sent him to AAA after that. I thought that was going to be his last start, even if he was healthy. He was just so bad. And they brought him back as a reliever, and of course he dominated in relief because, you know, as a starter, he's throwing 97, 98 with a nasty slider. And then you put him in relief, and he was just blowing hitters away. So that happened, and then, of course, you had all those people saying, just leave him in the bullpen and, you know, enjoy having this dominant reliever. And the Yankees are never going to do that. The Yankees always said they believed in Severino as a starter. And to Severino's credit, last season was basically just a problem with his command. You know, he does have a changeup. You know, a lot of young pitchers come up, they don't really have a changeup, or they're still trying to learn it. He had the changeup, and he just left too many pitches over the plate. And so the Yankees gave him a chance to start again in spring training. he didn't actually pitch that well in spring training. The thing is, the Yankees had five candidates for the last two rotation spots, and nobody pitched well. And so Severino kind of got it by default. And this season, he looks so much better than he did at any time last year. His stuff has been great, but he's locating it much better. He looks better now than he did in 2015. You know, he's not going to be this good all year, obviously, mm-hmm. but he just looks like a major league pitcher who just belongs in a starting rotation, not just some guy who is learning on the fly. That is much more promising because the Yankees, they have no starting pitching beyond this year. Sabathia is going to be a free agent. You know, Sabathia reinvented himself and is now a serviceable big league starter late in his career, but he's going to be a free agent. Pineda is going to be a free agent. Tanaka can opt out. So the Yankees have, like, no pitching under control beyond this season. So they need somebody to step up and kind of take over as a rotation piece. And Severino has the highest ceiling of their young starters. They want it to be him, and it looks like it's happening. So we'll see how his command holds up the rest of the season. Because that has always been kind of the biggest issue for him is, can he locate consistently? He's done it so far this year. And get him through the season, get him up to 170 innings or whatever it's going to be. You know, that's more important. You know, with all the position players they have with Judge and Sanchez and Bird, they got to figure out the pitching more than anything. And Severino's key there. Jordan Montgomery, who ended up getting the fifth starter spot, wasn't even like a consideration in spring training, but he outpitched everyone, so they took him. He's not like a high ceiling player. He's more of a kind of a back end pitcher. You know, he's like a college lefty who throws five pitches but touches maybe 92 on a good day. He's pitched fairly well, and the Yankees kind of got to hope that he turns into something just to give them some rotation options going forward. You know, Severino's the key because he's someone who could be at the front of the rotation, and what he's done so far this year, it's so much better than last year, and the Yankees have to be really encouraged that he looks like the 2015 version of Severino again. He actually looks better in many ways because he's throwing his changeup more.
Yeah, what can you tell me about Montgomery? I read the Pleskov scouting report, and I kind of scoffed at it because he said Chris Sale, but which is preposterous. Chris Sale was in the big leagues at 21 or 22, and Montgomery's 24 right now. But obviously numbers impressive and did enough in spring training and whatever to force the hand of the Yankees as opposed to, you know, some of the other secondary guys. But do you see someone here that could be a decent middle-of-the-rotation guy or number two or number four? Or, you know, where do you stand
on him? He's probably like a 3, 4, 5 kind of guy somewhere in there. You know, the Sale stuff is, I don't even know where that would come from because they're nothing alike other than being left-handed. And the one I've had somebody tell me, I've actually had more than one person tell me that Montgomery reminds them of Jay Happ.
And yeah, I thought, that'd be all right.
Like, okay, that kind of makes sense. Because the thing with Montgomery is that he's they drafted him, I think, 4 years ago, and he's in his college career at South Carolina. He was in the rotation all 3 years, so it was 3 years in an SEC rotation, pitched in the College World Series. This guy never missed a start his entire career, so he's one thing we've seen from him so far is that he's basically unflappable on the mound. Like, nothing kind of bothers him. His first start, you know, struck out the first batter, struck out the second batter, then walked the guy and gave up a home run. And you're like, oh, well, the wheels might come off. But they didn't. He just settled down, went through a start. And he does. Montgomery, his location has to be really good because he doesn't throw hard. But he does have a really good changeup. He's got a curveball. He pitches inside a ton. I was kind of taken aback at how much he pitched inside because you just don't see many pitchers do it that day. But he pitches these days. You don't see that happen often, but he's keeps going after righties inside. So that's kind of what he has to do to succeed. And I think if as long as his location is fine, you know, if you watch him pitch, Montgomery's like 6'6", and he releases the ball like straight over the top. So he's got this like extreme downhill angle. It's really kind of weird to watch because you're not used to seeing pitchers throw from that high over. So he's got, you know, he succeeds by throwing downhill, by mixing five pitches in and staying out of the middle of a plate. As long as he does that, I could think he could be like a 3-4 guy like Cap, and that's kind of the best case scenario there. You know, Yankee fans are always a little ridiculous with this stuff. They see a lefty who has success, oh, he's going to be the next Andy Pettit, but that's not the case here. He's not the same pitcher. And Montgomery just looks like he could be a useful starter who's nice to have in his cheap years. You know, I think he's 25 already, so it's not like this is a 22-year-old kid. You know, 3 years in college, 3 years in the minors, and now he's getting a chance. And looks like he could be a useful pitcher, and the Yankees need that. You know, you don't want to go out and have to spend $10 million a year to sign a fifth starter. You'd rather just grow your own, pay him $600,000 a year, and it looks like Montgomery could be that guy for the Yankees.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit like the Twins going out and signing Ricky Nolasco, Irvin Santana, and all those guys, which, you know, one worked, one didn't, so it's kind of how it goes. So the Yankees, this is the last thing I got for you, at 11-7. How long can they hang in this division? Obviously, Boston bothered by the David Price injury. Toronto looks like a nightmare. Baltimore does what Baltimore does, and who knows what Tampa Bay is going to do because they are the ultimate wild card of all wild cards. But how long do you think the Yankees can hang in the mix here, not only in the division but in the wild card?
Probably like last year. I think they'll be in it into September. You know, last year they traded away everybody at the deadline. They basically threw in the towel on the season. And then they started winning. You know, at one point they were two games out of a wild card spot with 5 weeks to play, and you know, that was after trading Chapman, trading Miller, Beltran, Nova. You know, the Yankees, over the last, they played one playoff game the last 4 years, and they haven't had good seasons by Yankee standards, but their worst win total in the last, like, 25 years is 84 games. And if a bad season is winning 84 games, you know, you could do worse there. And the projections always say the Yankees are kind of on the precipice of really kind of falling off and winning 75 games and really having kind of a disaster season. But every year they outperform their expectations, they outperform the projections, they outperform their run differential. And, you know, it happens once or twice, and maybe it's kind of a fluke, but it happens every year. I kind of wonder if that's something from Joe Girardi and the coaching staff or the players in the clubhouse and the leadership there, but it happens so often I can't rule it out. So I think, again, the Yankees are going to be better than everyone expects. Not sure if they'll be good enough to get to the postseason because they do worry about, you know, what happens when Gary Sanchez catches 130 games for the first time and Aaron Judge plays 150 for the first time and Severino's on an innings limit. So I'm not really sure how things are going to go once the young players start to wear down a bit. But I think they'll be in the, you know, the AL East is such like a mess right now. I knew the Blue Jays weren't going to be as good as they were last year. I didn't think they'd be this bad. And the Rays are, I don't know, I never really bought them in as a serious contender, but they're still going to be hanging around the Rays. And the Red Sox, they just don't hit home runs anymore, but they're good enough at everything else that I still think they're the favorites to win the division. And as long as the rest of those AL East teams keep beating up on each other, the Yankees will hang around the race. And, you know, considering they're in the middle of a rebuild, you know, they don't call it a rebuild, they call it a transition, the Yankees. As long as they're doing this and kind of staying in the race and being interesting, you know, I think that's much better than tanking like the Astros did and losing 100 games year after year where they're just so unwatchably bad. So I think they'll be good enough to stay in the postseason race into September. I'm not sure if they're gonna be good enough to get in. You know, it'll take some things going right, like Pineda actually putting it together and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm not completely ruling it out, but I think they're going to end up winning 85 wins again. And, you know, they'll get eliminated from postseason contention with like 5 days to go in the season again like last year. And that's kind of where I see it heading. Except this time they're going to have more young players on the roster and you're going to feel better going into next season.
Well, Mike, thank you for your time. Let's check back up with you again later in the season, see where the Yankees are standing, see where the Twins are standing, and hopefully they'll both be in good positions.
Sure, happy to come on.
All right, that was Mike Agzisa. You can find him on Twitter at MikeAxisa. You can see him on CBS Sports. For Tom Schreier Producing, I'm Brandon Warren. Thank you for listening to the Midwest Swing Podcast as part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.